One of the things that people say that parenthood does for you is that it more or less forces you to become a more patient person. You've got to clean up all kinds of unholy messes. You have to learn things like how to push a trolley through a supermarket holding one crying child in your arm while the older one is telling you how hungry she is. John C. Thompson did all this as a single dad with a huge brood of kids, and he did it minus a leg and a hand. The other hand only has a few fingers on it. John was a working-class boy who grew up in Melbourne. He joined the army as a teenager, where he was trained as a field engineer, and in 1967, he was posted to Vietnam. Everyone had a nickname in the army, so he was dubbed Jethro, and then one day Jethro was sent to work in a minefield. That was the beginning of Jethro's life as a multiple amputee, but it was also the start of his full-on life as a family man. But then life had some more grenades to throw at him. It's only now that Jethro's had anything like the time to set the whole story down in a memoir called A Vietnam Vet's Remarkable Life. Hello, Jethro.
Hi, Richard.
When you're out and about and people say what happened to you, what do you tell them?
Depending on the mood that I'm in, if I was on the beach, I'd say I was a shark attack victim. If I was in a pub, I'd say I was riding my motorbike with one too many. A lot depends on the nature of the person asking. Some are pretty rude, so I more or less say a load of BS to them.
Yeah.
But where it matters, I tell people truthfully. And once I got myself conditioned to telling the truth, there was a lot of avoidance in me for many, many years. Denial. A lot of denial.
And to confront the truth of that, does that feel better now, or are you a bit wobbly after it?
No, I'm very comfortable where I am. I'm very at ease with myself. I've put it on paper to the best of my ability, and so there's no going back.
What about the physical process of writing the book, because you've got a few less fingers than the rest of us?
People are surprised. They said, and who typed it for you? I say, I did. With my one finger, with the seek and peck method of searching the keyboard, clunk, 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 all the time. I was quite annoyed when my manuscript went for the first appraisal and it came back with the suggestion that I had to drop about 75,000 words. Mate, I had put in a big effort and then I had to start chopping it all back.
That's work too, with the delete key.
That is work, yeah. It was hard work.
I do have to ask you, there is a story behind Jethro, the name itself. It seemed like everyone who went to Vietnam got a nickname. Yours was Jethro. How did you acquire it?
I got my nickname when I was in Borneo in 1965. And we were building a road up and over a mountain range. It was all very hard physical work. And on this particular day, we received a hot box meal at lunchtime, which was great. Normally it was just you had a big breakfast and a good dinner that night, but you had a bit of stale bread and cheese at lunchtime. And the corporal, my mate Tommy Upson, happened to notice that the one container that was supposed to contain the meat was empty, so he sent the driver back. And while I was sitting there, I lifted the lid on a container and thought, oh, lovely boiled potatoes. So I stuck my right hand in and had one. Had another one. Ultimately, I heard the scratching sounds of my fingernails on the empty container, and I thought, I'm in trouble now. So I moved away, and the meat eventually arrived, and Tom opened up all the containers to start serving, and he just looked in the pot. He looked at me, and he said, Thompson, you guts. And I thought, hello, there's going to be a hanging any minute with my neck in the noose. But we're this great old guy, we used to call him Black Charlie, he was a Welshman, real old soldier. And he looked in the pot and he said, not even Jethro could eat that much. Well, that broke everybody up and the name stuck like mud on a blanket.
Is this Jethro from the Beverly Hillbillies?
Beverly Hillbillies.
Going swimming in the cement pond, that guy.
Yes, yeah. Well, he'd have a packet of cornflakes for breakfast. I mean, he was a fang. And I was a bit of a fang too.
Why did you want to join the army in the first place, Jethro?
I was going nowhere at school. I really feel I had a a learning problem. I couldn't spell, couldn't add up. I got a job in a stainless steel sheet metal factory, and it was noisy, and it was dirty, and it was relatively dangerous. I was always cutting myself, especially my fingers. I'd many a time at the Royal Melbourne Hospital casualty department had fingers stitched up. I lived near a council work depot, and I used to see all the plant equipment, and I was always interested in what it would be like to go and drive some of this equipment. And a family friend said, "You want to drive that stuff, join the army and they'll teach you." And so I thought, well, I'll join the army. And when I came home and told my mum that I'm joining the army, she was ecstatic. She was
ecstatic.
Over the moon. Yeah. She hated me coming home from the sheet metal factory with fingers all cut. Oh. She was happy that I was going into the army because she thought it would be nice and safe. Vietnam, of course, wasn't on the horizon or just reaching the horizon in 1964.
So, you were first deployed to Borneo. Did you actually get to operate that kind of equipment, that road-making equipment you were hoping to?
Not in Borneo. In Borneo, it was all physical labour, really. I managed a chainsaw and an axe and lots of explosives, bringing down 500, 600-year-old rainforest trees. Really, we were a greenies nightmare, the damage that we did. But we were building a road. It was an access road. It was enjoyable work. Then when I got home back to Inogra, I got to go on a course and started learning how to drive bulldozers, graders, scrapers, cranes. And I was like a big boy in a sandpit with big Tonka toys. Loved it. I often stop and watch on the road. I like to watch how they're working, and I look on with a bit of envy because my opportunities were cut short.
So you were deployed to Vietnam. How did your family send you off to Vietnam?
I left from Sydney, but my family lived in Melbourne, and I did have a week's leave where I went down to Melbourne, had Christmas and break. I ended up with about a two-week break, which was good. I was travelling by train in those days. My father and two sisters accompanied me to the Spencer Street railway station. I wouldn't let my mother come because she was Maltese and a very emotional Mediterranean person. So I knew I wouldn't be able to handle that. So we had that in private at home and off I went.
How old were you when you were deployed?
21.
21 years old. What do you remember of arriving in Saigon when the plane landed there, the sights and smells of the place?
Oh, it was noisy, it was hot, it was a buzz, there was lots of activity. We mainly travelled from the airport to an American camp, Camp Alpha, which is like a staging camp, and all we saw was military vehicles running every way, and so many well-armed and like hand grenades hanging off uniforms everywhere, machine guns. You knew you were in a war zone.
What was your role to be in Vietnam?
Well, I went as a plant operator. I wasn't happy about that. I was hoping to have gone to 17 Construction Squadron, which was on the beach at Vung Dao. And by the name says it all, it was into the heavy work, and that's what I wanted to be doing. But because I went to a field squadron, their primary role was to support the infantry. So although I could work on machinery while in camp, when an operation was on, I would have to go and support the infantry, looking after, tunnel searching, booby traps, demolitions, exploding bombs, unexploded bombs.
This meant you had to go on patrol, didn't it?
Yes, we'd have two sappers, two engineers with an infantry platoon, and you did whatever they did.
What's your role on patrol then, as a specialist?
Well, you would be patrolling along. We were generally in the headquarters section, but if the forward scouts or anything was discovered, your role was then to go and have a look at it.
Like booby traps, you mean?
Booby traps, suspicious vines that may have been blown across a track. You wouldn't know. You'd see a vine that looked out of place. Forward scout would ask you to come forward, and you would follow it because a loose vine could be attached to a bomb at one end and hook on somebody's boot at the other end and trigger a major explosion. And so you would have to search and make sure. Fortunately, just about on every occasion, I never discovered anything as sinister as a bomb at the other end. It was still heart-beating stuff.
Would you go at night, patrol at night, or during the day?
No, not really at night. We were out. We'd stay out overnight. We'd stay out for 5 or 6 weeks, sleeping out there. A lot of artillery shells would be spotted. You would have to blow them up. Whatever booby traps, grenades, hand grenades fixed to trees with trip wires. And on one occasion, we found two enormous rice stacks that the enemy had camouflaged in the jungle, and they were heavily booby-trapped. If you imagine a big sack of rice, they would put a bomb in one bag, bring the copper wire out through the ear on the bag, put it in the adjacent bag, so whichever bag was picked up to throw on your shoulder triggered the explosion, and the damage was done.
Nerve-wracking work.
It was. We were lucky to have found it. And we'd relaxed our guard a little bit on that occasion because the whole area was surrounded with a lot of booby traps. We're near a tidal creek and there was a lot of seashells. And I can remember, like, kids, you go walking along stomping on these shells. Then we realised, what are they doing here on this track? And we froze and had a look, and sure enough, there was a bomb under one of those shells. It was a modified cluster bomb, otherwise known as a butterfly bomb. There were thousands of them would come out of the sky and scatter everywhere, and the enemy would pick them up, reposition them, and the aim was to get us.
Occasionally you'd walk into abandoned Viet Cong posts and see how they'd been living. What kind of things would you see?
You would find a few straw huts, weapon pits with overhead protection. There would be cooking fires. Generally, they'd still be warm because they'd moved because they knew we were coming. You would find pretty primitive sleeping quarters, hammocks slung up between trees.
It's a bit like going into someone's house, isn't it?
Sneaking it was. Yeah. And we were very destructive, because we would go in and destroy anything that we found and burn it. If we could, we would burn it to the ground.
How quickly did the novelty of finding and destroying these enemy camps wear off?
It wore off after a while, because each time you were thinking, well, it's the danger, it's this uncertainty. We figured that ultimately we're going to meet an enemy force that's going to stand its ground, and I certainly didn't want to get too involved in a shooting war.
So you were sent then to a minefield at Horseshoe.
The Horseshoe was a extinct volcano and it had become a fire support base. A minefield was being built from the little town of Dat Do to the coast to basically cut the province in half and deny free-flowing passage of enemy troops and carters.
How were you told you were going to be working in that minefield?
I wasn't.
You weren't?
All my friends, except for fellow plan operators, they all went out and they started to lay the minefield. They put two small minefields in around the Horseshoe feature, and then what was known as the Barrier Minefield. That was going to be 11 kilometres to the coast, something like 22,000 landmines with hand grenades underneath them with an anti-lift device. But because of progress, the hierarchy wanted a greater effort, more mines laid each day. On the night before I went, I was coming out of the mess hall or mess tent. I was told I was going. I said, "Are you joking?" But sure enough, I was told to have my kit packed and be at the chopper pad in the morning, and off we went.
So your job was to lay these mines?
The infantry, 5 battalion fellows, built the two barrier fences, the barbed wire fences, about, we'll say, 100 metres apart. And within that 100 metres, we then had 3 mine lanes, six strips of mines, probably a metre apart, each mine, each cluster. There was a four-mine cluster.
And had you ever operated or primed a mine, landmine before?
No, I had not seen the landmines. I was familiar with a hand grenade, although not the switch that the anti-lift device that was exchanged for the normal plunger.
What do you mean by anti-lift device?
Well, if you can imagine a hand grenade, imagine a something the size of a box of matches sitting on top. That was an anti-lift device. Once you took the pin out, the top would flip off and ignite the hand grenade. It needed about 4 or 5 or possibly more pounds of downward pressure. So it needed a landmine, which was about the size of a 500-gram tin of jam. That's what the landmine looked like. You needed that weight sitting on top of the hand grenade to stop it from exploding.
So when you were laying these mines, then you'd put the hand grenade down first, yeah, and then lay the landmine on top
on
of that,
top of it.
That
you'd
switch.
Balance it on top of the switch.
And then pull the pin out?
Yes, well, you'd backfill with some dirt to get some stability. The pins in the anti-lift switch had two pins. It had a safety pin and a safety pin. You pull the first one out, and if there was no reaction, you then safely pulled out the second one.
What was your state of mind like as you were laying these?
I hated the place. I hated being there. I hated doing the job, but I knew it was a job that I had to do because I wore the badge. I was part of the Corps.
It's Tuesday, the 9th of May, 1967. You'd been asked to speed up the process. What did that mean?
Well, the boys, there's probably about 35, 40 fellows involved. And we were comfortably laying about 400 landmines a day. The way it operated initially was the guys were basically doing what they were comfortable doing. Because I didn't like laying or arming the landmines, I would do other jobs. I would carry, I would dig, I would go and get. I worked hard, but I did not actually squat over the mines and pull the pins out. When, on the 9th of May, the hierarchy said, we've got to increase the arming rate, so our immediate bosses said, right, you all have to work in your section and rotate. There'd be no exemption from any of the jobs. You all had to do the same job. That'd be about 2 hours work, then you'd rotate to another job. My section, one section, we got the job of arming mines, and whether we wanted to or not, we had to do it. So we had to arm 5 clusters, that's 5 sets of 4 landmines, plus the hand grenade underneath. And that took us an hour and a half to 2 hours. And at the completion of that, we could step back onto a safe lane, walk out of the minefield, and we would have a drink of water, the guys who wanted to smoke, and wait to be redirected to another job. But unfortunately, our staff sergeant came along, and I don't know, he had a bee in his bonnet about something, but he more or less said no, whether he didn't know those orders we had been given, or whether he was just disregarding them, he made us all go back.
What did you say to him when
he
said
that? I had a lot to say, unfortunately. I have a respect for authority, but on that occasion I let the side down because, first of all, our NCO, our corporal, tried to explain what had happened. That didn't matter. It didn't mean a thing to him. We had to go back, and he would tell us when we finished.
All right. He was doing the I'm the boss.
I'm the boss. Go back. Do as I say. But one of our guys had not brought his equipment with him, his kit, and I had lent him one of my water bottles. So I had 2 water bottles, which probably doesn't sound much, but might take a few extra minutes to get yourself stowed away and move on. So that guy gave me the bottle, I was putting the 2 back, And the staff sergeant came back and I was still there. And he got up me for being slow and being tardy. He berated me big time.
So you got a bit of the Anzac spirit, Anzacs in Egypt.
Yeah, that's at that point. It. Yeah. So when I eventually went up the safe lane to pick up my flak jacket to start work, he came back from the opposite direction and he got up me again. And I just couldn't believe this.
Why?
Because I'd taken too long to get in there and my partner was standing over there waiting for me to arrive. And
but you were putting on protective clothing.
Oh, yeah, for what it was, just a flak jacket and a tin hat. But he got right up me and I thought, I've had this. So I gave him a gob full of cheek, lost my composure totally, saw my friend waiting for me and just walked across to where he was. The mistake I had made is the flak jacket that was left waiting for me was not the one that I had taken off. I mistakenly believed that that was the flak jacket that I had put down, and so I was going for it. The guys before me had picked up mine and moved in on the other side of the tape. So having, I'd gone further up the safe tape, so that between my partner and I was a cluster of mines, which I wasn't aware of. I should have been, but because I'd been distracted, and I walked straight across and I actually kicked the last mine that we had laid.
Was there any kind of telltale sound? A click or anything like that?
No.
It's not like the movies then? No.
I certainly never heard any clicks. All I felt more than I heard, as I walked across to my friend Ashley, I felt the rush of air. I felt myself going up in the air. And then I heard the whimper, the noise hit me after that. And I was lying on the ground and I knew I was a mess. And I saw looking at my hands as I was looking up at all the debris drifting down, just slowly floating down over me, and my hands, well, they were just red with blood and fingers were hanging off everywhere. And I knew I was trying to get up, but there was no way I was moving. And then my friends had all gathered around and started administering first aid. My troop sergeant, Brett Nolan, was squatting over me and my troop lieutenant was there. And I had a feeling my leg had gone, that I'd blown it off, because I had seen something like that happen a week or so earlier with some Americans who had gone into a minefield. They'd actually literally climbed through the fence and went in, disregarding the warning signs. So I knew what to expect. Little did I know, there was six guys had been knocked over, four was rather seriously. Sadly, two died, and Ashley passed away 2 years ago, but he mainly had a lot of shrapnel in the head and face. But I had it all. Fortunately, I had my flak jacket on, so my upper body was spared. I did get shrapnel up around my eyes and my ears. Lucky it didn't blind me, but knocked a pretty big hole. I've got a rearranged belly button. And my belly came out, and the boys had a lot of work putting me together, keeping me together.
What did you know in that moment, though, after the explosion? You said you had an apprehension you might have lost a leg. Did you know that?
Well, I couldn't move. It was just, I could move one leg, but the other white leg was just sort of flopping. And I did discover later that it was only attached by shreds of flesh. Like the bone, it had just shattered me right through between the knee and the hip. It had just blown it all out and was only shreds of flesh that kept it connected to me, really.
Were you in pain at that moment?
Not at the time. I don't recall pain. I knew I was in a pretty bad way and I was lying looking at the sun and I shut my eyes. And then I had that first flash that, hey, this is the end. I'm going to die. But so I said, open your eyes, you silly bugger. Look around, take it all in. You're going to be dead soon. It'll all be over.
You had that thought?
Yes, as I lie on the ground.
Well, can you remember what that voice was like?
I said to myself, open your eyes, because you're going to be dead. I had that vision. So I opened my eyes, and my troop sergeant, Brett Nolan, was in front of me, and I kept moving my head to keep me in the shade.
On air, online, and on your mobile, you're listening to Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Radio. Subscribe to our free podcast service. Details on our website, abc.net.au/conversations.
John Jethro Thompson is a Vietnam veteran. One day in Vietnam, while working in the infamous Barrier minefield, Jethro stood on a landmine. Jethro, it sounds like you were strangely pragmatic in that moment. Like, I've been blown up by mine, so I'd better sort myself out and get ready to die. Strangely rational. Is that how it was?
No, I think you're quite on. It was a fact. I felt I was in an undeniable situation. That's what was going to happen. That's what you expect to happen. Other friends of mine who did the same thing perished instantly, bang, gone. But for some reason, whether it was my flak jacket that had protected me, I think I was in shock, but I survived. And I remember being carted off to the hospital. Blood was the big problem. I see my sergeant, Brett, ripping, what do they call them?
Gauze bandage? Or
the bandages, yeah, shell dressings, with his teeth and trying to slap them onto me. And he was complaining about how small they were and how inadequate they were. I heard the choppers come down. I got carted off, and I remember the guy looking at me and then making some comment to the pilot. Pretty gloomy-looking character, the Australian medic on the RAF chopper. We went to Vung Tau. There was an Australian hospital there, but it was in its infancy. And because of the nature of our injuries and the number involved, they wouldn't have been able to help us or cope with us. So the flight was directed to the American hospital, the 36th Evacuation Hospital in Vung Tau.
Do you have any memory of arriving there?
Oh, yes, very much so. When we landed, I remember this most gorgeous blonde, blue-eyed nurse in her army fatigues with a clipboard and biro, asked me all sorts of crazy questions like, am I allergic to this? Have I had needles for that? And I'm saying yes, yes, yes to everything. But I was being distracted by this big American, African-American medic standing behind her with a great big set of shears in his hands, clippers. And I thought, where's he going with those? And he was getting ready to cut off my flak jacket and the rest of my clothing. So that was a bit of a distraction. And when we got away from the helicopter and inside, I could hear all the commotion, the doctors yelling, and everybody was yelling instructions. And I can remember people yelling out to hold one of the helicopters, because two of the guys, I discovered later, who had head injuries were being transferred to another hospital further north in Vietnam, where the appropriate specialist would have been based. Fortunately for me, the orthopaedic people were at 36 of ACT.
So then you were anaesthetised?
I was indeed, and my army record shows that I shut my eyes just over an hour after the explosion, and I think it was about 8 or 9 hours later that I reopened them in the dark, in a ward. All I could see was coloured lights, and I was very confused by that. It was dark, and although I was in what appeared to be a modern hospital bed, I could see only ugly old hospital beds. And I thought, I'm in a storeroom. I really thought I'd gone to heaven or hell, that I was waiting somewhere to be carted off. And then as I moved around, I saw a bloke in the next bed sitting up looking at me. And I said, g'day, and he didn't respond. And so I said, g'day, and he still didn't respond. And I thought, well, stuff you too. I later discovered that his jaw was wide up and he couldn't speak. But because I was moving, of Corman then, an American medic came over and started attending to my needs and telling me where I was. And they were just surplus beds at one end, and the lights were over the nurse's station.
What did the doctor tell you about the injuries you'd suffered?
Well, they didn't come in till much later after. I recall they were serving breakfast, and I was pretty hungry, and I'd asked one nurse if I was going to get breakfast, and she said, not till after the doctors have seen you. And eventually the doctor did come, and he told me that my leg had gone and my hands were a mess and so on.
How about your torso? Didn't you get some shrapnel in your
guts? I
got
a lot, yeah. They actually opened me up and they felt I was in pretty good nick, all things considered. There was no serious damage done.
Did that mean you could eat?
I was able to eat and drink almost straight away. It was just a very, very busy place to be, so there was plenty of distractions during the day, but the nights were very long.
How much surgery did you need over the next few days?
Oh, I must have gone in and out of surgery in the 40 days that I was in that hospital 6 or 7 times. My right hand had only suffered the loss of a fingertip, but it had gone through the wrist, and about 10 days later, they came and said, this hand was a mess. My left hand was just a mess. The back was all open and had pins sticking in and out of it. And the doctor came and he said, I'm sorry, Jethro, but we're going to have to go to surgery. We're going to have to remove your hand. And I offered my left hand and said, well, doesn't look like it's going to be much good to me. And he said, I'm really sorry. It's the right hand. That brought tears to my eyes. They had slashed my wrists and they were unable to maintain circulation and blood flow. That's why my right hand was amputated.
What was your state of mind like as your time evolved in hospital?
I kept thinking about my mother and how my mother was going to react, because it was just before Mother's Day and I'd sent flowers from the minefield. We had an officer come out taking orders. I'd arranged to send Mother's Day flowers, and I had visions of my mother's reaction, and they were disturbing. And
were you really worried more about your mum's reaction than your own future and your own hands?
At that stage, initially, I had these visions, and because I really didn't know how bad I was, but then when the penny dropped, I was quite a useless package of goods. Not capable of doing anything for myself, and that's when the rot set in.
You got sicker then, didn't you, at one point? Something got bad, yes. Something went wrong.
Yes. Oh, everything was going great. My friends were coming in. Bringing that much beer in, it wasn't funny. We took up the whole fridge, the medicine fridge. I had beer under the bed. The other patients thought it was wonderful.
Well, you were the beer dispensary
after that. Yeah, that's right. But unfortunately, one day there, I just got an enormous temperature. I was hitting 104 Fahrenheit, and they had me packed on ice. And then my belly, it was just like I was a pregnant cow. It was terrible, and they said they didn't know what was going on. And eventually they did surgery, and they discovered that in their exploratory surgery, they had not noticed fine perforation from the shrapnel in my small intestine.
Right, so you've got a terrible infection.
That's what was doing the damage.
It's horrible to be recovering and then to go backwards, isn't it?
It was. Yeah. Well, in the hospital ward, you stayed right in the middle, and as you improved, you moved a little bit closer to the door, and I was moving towards the door, and then I'd come back at several goes. I'd be booked on a flight to come home and then be cancelled because I'd be crook. So it was pretty disappointing. But that's when I really suffered my weight just fell away, and I was a sick boy for quite a while.
You received a great kindness from a nurse there.
Beautiful person, an African-American nurse from New York, Gert Baker, and all the nurses were great. They treated me so well, but on this occasion, they couldn't do anything to pacify me. I was in pain, I was uncomfortable, I was miserable, and Gert came and got up on the bed with me and cuddled into me like I was her child. And mate, I just melted. I was like butter on a hot day. She could have done anything to me that day. We did have a few confrontations, old Gert and I, though. I refused to take my anti-malaria pill at one stage, and she came over and started to comfort me. She put her fingers up on my nose and squeezed it till I opened my mouth, threw the pills in, and she said, "You can do whatever you like, but not when I'm in charge." Things like that, you know. She was just so good. And
but she held you. She held you.
She nursed me. She actually cuddled into me.
Did that do anything for your pain or your suffering when she did that?
It made me feel wanted. It really did. It made me feel that I was of value to somebody. I had a worth about me. No, it was a wonderful feeling. It really was. Unfortunately, Gert died about 6 years ago, but not before I'd met up with her on a couple of occasions in America.
What state were you in when you got back to Australia?
I was very fragile, and I was obviously on the depressed side. I saw no future for myself. I wondered how the hell I was ever going to make a quid. What am I going to do for the rest of my life? I used to have visions of myself growing old with a wooden leg and sitting at home on Saturday night with Mum and Dad watching TV. Life wasn't looking real good.
That wasn't you before the war, was it?
No,
it
definitely wasn't me.
You're a bit of a Jack the Lad, going out and having fun.
Well, I was a young man.
Yes, you were a young man.
I was a healthy young man who loved to go out and chase the ladies and was thrilled when he caught them. And I was enjoying my life.
Did you experience phantom limb syndrome?
Yes, I did, and that was hard to take, and I still have it, actually. I still get a lot in my left leg and my right hand.
Is it an itch or of some kind, or does it just feel like it's there?
In my hand, it's like I have a clenched fist, but I can't open it because it's encased within my arm, you know, like it's trapped. But they come and go.
Does it bother you still, or do you just learn to live with it?
Oh, you live with it, but the worst part that we amputees have trouble explaining to doctors is what is known as a nerve storm. You get this massive convulsion. I have actually thrown myself out of bed because I'll be lying quietly, and then all of a sudden I get this uncontrollable kicking in my left stump, and I've fallen out of bed. I've hit my wife. She'll know when I've got it. And the only cure I ever found for it was several Panadol and a pretty good dose of port.
Tell me about the first time you saw your whole body in the mirror.
I was not impressed. Like all young men, we have a certain understanding of our body image and how we look to other people. And when I saw myself, I was in my sister's bedroom and she had the full-length mirror, and I thought, oh my God, I was skinny. My willy was longer than my left leg. It was hanging down further than my left leg. It was so short. That sent me into shock. I thought, I'm so close not to have lost the wedding tackle. Came awfully close. And then I look funny, I look like a clock with a long arm and a short arm with my two arms. And as I turned around, reached over my shoulder, I could see all this black shrapnel in my backside and at the back of my leg. I knew why my friend Kevin used to call me Leopard Bum, because he'd see me getting in and out of bed and I'd have all these black spots and the scars across the right cheek and the back of my knee and back of my right thigh. No, I didn't feel good. I was horrified by it all.
It took a while for you to find an artificial leg that worked for you because you had so little of your leg.
I had very little leg, yeah. And to the department's credit, the people, the limb makers, who in the main were POWs of the Japanese, had lost their own limbs and manufactured temporary ones, are working in South Melbourne at the Artificial Limb and Appliance Centre, and they were just so committed to making me a leg. They tried everything to get a, what I'll call a conventional suction leg to stay on. I could get it on and I could walk with it, but as soon as I sat down, there'd be a real blurting like somebody passing wind and it would fall off.
As this thing came unstuck,
yeah,
that kind of
exactly,
thing, right?
Exactly, yeah.
Oh, dear.
It would fall off. So ultimately they said, well, really the best thing for you is to go into this Canadian hip. And they said, it's very uncomfortable. If you could imagine like a plastic bucket with that you sat in when you had where my leg was, shoved up a plastic bucket, so it encased my body. So wrapped right around me, this fiberglass bucket.
So your waist, it was supported by your waist and hips then?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And my good leg, and it had a hip joint and a knee joint. And the doctor at the time, he said, your stump is too long. And I got a bit annoyed because for one leg it was too short, for this leg it was going to be too long. So I said, well, cut a bit more off. We don't do surgery just like that. And eventually he was persuaded that we should try, and it worked a treat. I had no trouble with it at all. Little did I know that over the years I would injure my facet joints, and probably about 10 years ago my orthopedic specialist told me that due to excessive pelvic thrust, which did put a smile on my face, my pelvic facet joints have been compressed, so I had to stop wearing the leg. So I had a good pair of crutches made, a gutter crutches. I galloped around on these crutches for a long time, but ultimately they adversely affected my shoulders. I've had both shoulders reconstructed, and I'm in a wheelchair now because of my, when I had my second open heart surgery, I originally had a tissue, an animal valve, aortic valve, but I got an infection which ruined that, so they put a mechanical valve, and because I'm on daily dose of warfarin, I can't afford to fall over, so I was in the wheelchair.
Tell me about Judy, Jethro.
Judy was a delightful lady. She was the widowed sister of a Vietnam veteran friend that I had in Melbourne. He invited me to round to see his handiwork one day. He was doing something in the backyard, and I met Judy. I was very taken by her appearance, beautiful red-headed lady. And on the second visit, I asked her out, and it was a yes, but we had two children in tow because she'd had a young boy and a young daughter. So that was fine, and we got on really well, and we got married probably 6 months later. And then the following year, we had our first child. We ended up having three more girls. So we had the five children. I was then working in the public service. I transferred to the Geelong office. Everything was going good. Life was really good. And then after the birth of the last child, she started having pain. They said, postnatal problems. Well, it turned out to be bowel cancer that had reached her liver. The doctors gave her 2 months to live. I had to leave my job, stay home, looked after her for 6 days less 1 year, just off the year. I did everything possible. We had a wonderful time while we could before she got too sick. She was an absolute delight. And the day of her funeral, I thought Vietnam was nothing to what I'm going to go through now. But Vietnam taught me that you have to get up and get going. I had my young children, So I got up and I kept going. It was a sad day, and I still reflect on the short time we had together.
But it meant after Judy died that you then had to look after five kids.
I looked after the five children.
And with a big heart, as you have, nonetheless, you're going to face some serious issues as a multiple amputee, just the business of changing nappies.
Yes, two of the girls were still in nappies, cloth nappies with safety pins. Good friends looked after Judith while, that's baby Judith, my youngest child, while I was nursing Judy. But when she came back to me, she was still in nappies and I had my hands full. And it was teamwork, you know, like I would have to dismantle myself when I got the smell.
What do you mean by dismantle yourself?
I'd take my arm off and take my leg off so I could handle the child.
Oh.
It wasn't that easy. I had to get down on the floor to change the nappy. So I'd lay the baby down or the child down. And then I'd be on the floor squatting beside her. I had the older kids around, and one would be holding this and another one would be holding that, and we'd have to do the cleaning and then trying to fold a cloth nappy and then pin it back together again. And we weren't that accurate with the pins, and we put one or two extra holes in the baby, but she survived. But it was hard work, but teamwork.
How much patience have you got now, John?
Oh, I think I'm a pretty patient person. I do everything slowly. I'm never in a hurry.
Do you think you were like that before the accident?
Or? Oh, no. No, I was always in a hurry. The young person, I couldn't get there quick enough. I might miss out on something. I always want to be at the front of the queue. But no, I've learnt to slow down, take it easy. And, you know, I don't mind if the plane's late at the airport. I'll sit there and just watch the people.
And then you met Pearl.
Then I met Pearl, my current wife. Pearl, likewise, was the widow of a Vietnam veteran. She had two boys, and we met at a legacy Christmas party, but I discovered she was also the niece of another army mate, and he rang me up and he suggested I should go visit Pearl one day. I rang up and she said, yes, I've heard about you. I saw you at the party the other day. And so she agreed to meet me. So off I went with the five kids. I mean, it's great dating with seven kids in tow.
So then you go from the Beverly Hillbillies to another American sitcom, The Brady Bunch.
That's it, literally, literally.
Wow.
The Brady Bunch, all right. Pearl and I, we went out for about 3 years and then we decided we would get married and come to Queensland. I figured two mother-in-laws in the one town was too many.
So these days, Anzac Day, do you like Anzac Day or not like Anzac Day?
I love Anzac Day because most times I go to Melbourne where I meet up with my friends who were there. The guys who are in the minefield with me. I see my troop sergeant. Although he's in Geelong and he's getting a bit past it now, he doesn't make the parade. But we get together and we run around, we sit in the corner, we have a drink or two and we reminisce and we congratulate ourselves on still being alive and having had such a good life. And we give full credit to a lot of it is due to the way the Army trained us and prepared us and what we got out of comradeship. Comradeship, you can't bottle it. If you could, you'd make a fortune. But comradeship is what comes out of facing hardship together and getting through it. And we thrive on it.
Not so long ago, Bob Ellis was on the program quoting his friend Les Murray, the poet, who was talking about the benefit as you get older of staying in touch with the people who knew you when you were a young man, when you were young and foolish. Mm. And as such, their price is above rubies, he says. Their price as friends. You laugh like you... You laugh in a different way, don't you, when you catch up with people who've known you, when you've been witness to all your youthful silliness?
Yeah, well, what the accuracy of the conversation, the memories, and we know the exaggeration is there for entertainment value. You know, don't let the truth spoil a good story, you know, like...
It's true enough.
Yeah, true enough, Clayton, but we know the guys who were there, my mate, the Ivan Scully's, the Max, the Kevin Smiths, that were all there. We were all there on the day.
I really enjoyed this conversation. Thank you so much.
Bet you say that to everybody.
I do, but I mean it with you.
That's nice to know.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.